Okay, so today we begin a new series. I'm actually hoping and intending to probably take this series over the course of probably several semesters. The idea is to go through Nath, through the Nevi'im Ketuvim, through the prophets and through the writings, and really glean out from them the practical lessons for everyday life. At the same time, getting a little overview of the various Nevi'im Ketuvim, what they contain in terms of the stories, and then in analyzing those stories as well. So we won't necessarily be taking a pasuk by pasuk, meaning a verse by verse approach, but instead we'll be focusing again more on the story and the lesson behind it. For today's class, my main goal is to introduce certain ideas about prophecy, and also why this particular approach has a great value to it. And I wouldn't say the complete and total value, but for the large part is one of the main ikari, and the main reasons why the Chachamim had, as they say, canonized, meaning that they set aside the texts to be Ladorot for all the generations, meaning that there were things that we were to glean out, not just some sort of prophecy of the Messiah coming, but far more than that, that we would be taking for us for the future. So the first sefer that we're going to be looking at is Sefer Yehoshua, and perhaps if there's time, we'll get a little bit into it in the beginning, and then, like I said, we're not going to spend, I don't know how many sfarim we'll go through in every particular semester, but the idea is, again, to hit the key ideas through a sefer and go from there. First of all, I'm sorry? So the first thing to start with is an understanding that there are really three types of communication. Perhaps there's more, but let's say there's three types of communication between God and man. That three major classifications. I'll actually say that there are far more, and as we go along, you'll see that that's the case. And in each one, there are different gradations, there are different levels of within them. The first type of communication that most people are familiar with is prophecy. Right, that's the first type. The second type, I would say, is Ruach HaKodesh. Right, is the divine inspiration, and what that means. And the third type of communication is what we glean from experience in life. Let's say tsarot, meaning troubles in life and things along those lines. So those are the three main ways that we find that HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicates with us. Within that framework, there are, like I said, levels. So, for example, in prophecy, you have varying levels, where certainly the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is, in a sense, almost could have its own category of communication. Because unlike the other prophets, it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God spoke peh el peh. He spoke face to face. He spoke mouth to mouth with Moshe Rabbeinu. What this means to say is that his prophecy didn't come in the normal fashion of prophecy, which, as the Ramchal in Derech Hashem, he goes through at length discussions about how prophecy was acquired and how it went about. There was a series of procedures that would be done, preparations. It wasn't something that just happened all of a sudden, although actually there were certain types of prophecies that could come all of a sudden to a person. But there was still a certain systematic way in which this occurred. It was sort of a meditative process followed by various different things that had to be certain. For example, before the prophets could prophesy, they had to be in a state of ecstasy, a state of happiness. So therefore, they would play music, or they would have meals, and so on. In other words, you had to be in a certain sense of levity beforehand, and the actual visions would occur to them almost as some sort of epileptic type of shaking and quaking that would occur, you know, in a almost violent type of fashion. Unless, of course, the higher the level of prophet was, the less of a physically shaking experience it was. So therefore, even within the levels, to the highest level of Moshe Rabbeinu, where there was barely any, to someone such as Shmuel, who at first didn't even realize that Kodesh Baruch was talking to him. He thought it was somebody else. He thought it was his Rebbe who was talking to him. He thought it was Yoel. That's who's speaking to him. So what happens is, again, as the level goes down, there's experience, but all the experiences of prophecy, they occur, with the exception of Moshe Rabbeinu, in some sort of almost like a semi-dream state that occurs there, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is transferring a certain experience, a metaphysical, spiritual experience to them, and that's what they're encountering. The second form of communication that we saw was that of, actually before we get to that, just to, in terms of Moshe Rabbeinu also, there was another significant difference in that prophecy in general would be a, Ari Kaplan actually goes at length to describe this idea that, that there would be sort of a download into the person's brain of whatever experience that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted for that person, and what would happen is that would then enter into his dream center within his mind, and that would be interpreted and bought into a visual or physical experience for the person that occurred through him. So there was the reality of the true thing that it was, which is beyond perception, and then there was the actual Navi who acted as a means for bringing about some sort of a physical representation of that experience, and that he would bring it down to something that could be, again, quantified. And then in the morning, the Navi would turn around, and he would write over his prophecy in his own language, and he would write it out again as this sort of poetic type of discussion that would happen. So, in a sense, all of the writings of the prophets are not letter for letter directly, God gave him the letter and he wrote it down, but rather it's a, his poetry, it's actually far more than just a poetry, and there's a certain level of divine inspiration in his writing, but it is actually something which he is bringing into the physical world through him as the conduit. Moshe Rabbeinu, though, was different in that it says that when the Kadosh Baruch Hu would speak, he would speak through Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy, and that's why I said maybe you could have a category unto itself, was that God, in other words, Moshe Rabbeinu's mouth would open and God would speak. Meaning that it was not a prophecy in the level of, again, where Moshe Rabbeinu had any sort of self within the issue. When Moshe Rabbeinu says, I am nothing, in terms of his level of anava, his level of humility, it's quite literally, he is nothing in the whole entire process. By the way, that is the key. We've talked about in many shurim that we've done in the past, is that the key midah, the key trait of being the ultimate human being is the trait of anava, is the trait of humility. On the flip side, the opposite and the base for all negative traits is gava, is self-centeredness. So being totally selfless is the ultimate goal of any human being, therefore the greatest amount of anava a person has, with the greatest selflessness that person would have, and therefore the greater profit would be have less of himself in the actual giving over of his prophecy. So Moshe Rabbeinu, being the most anav person on the face of the world, meaning the person who reached the highest level of selflessness, it only makes sense that his prophecy should be, again, totally selfless, meaning without his element in it, meaning a total, again, literally pass through from Moshe Rabbeinu onto the daf, literally onto the paper of the Sefer Torah that we have. The very last book, Sefer Devarim, happens to be slightly different in that Moshe Rabbeinu does have, there is an element of Moshe Rabbeinu within the Sefer, where it's more of a prophetic experience that occurs similar to a regular prophet, as opposed to the first four books, which letter for dot, every single thing was a direct, again, just a flow out from Moshe Rabbeinu onto the paper. This is prophecy. The second level, which we talked about, was Ruach HaKodesh, which is divine inspiration. Now, it's interesting, when you look at the two of them, I don't know always how fair it is to say which is greater, which is less, in a sense. What I mean by that is that there is a positive side. Since prophecy is something which is coming as literally like a dump from God, where he's transferring the information to the person, it has a far higher level. But what happens is that in prophecy, the prophet sees what HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly gives him to see. He has the experience that was designed for him and for him to give over to others. In Ruach HaKodesh, things are different. First of all, there are many levels in terms of what divine inspiration means. But in all of these levels, it comes through, as Rav Tzedakah Cohen explains, it comes through a person's level of chokhmah, his level of wisdom, his level of his experience in the learning of Torah. Meaning the greater his ability to learn, the greater his, much as ability, the greater he has actually been osek, that he has dealt with and he has delved into the Torah, the greater is his ability to obtain divine inspiration. And what's key here is that while Nevuah is sort of a coming up to down, divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh, is from the bottom up. Meaning that the person who attains a level of divine inspiration is capable of choosing where he wishes to go and what he chooses to see. Meaning that his experience is bound by his ability, and he's able to pursue it as far and as great as he can based on who he is. That doesn't necessarily mean to say that somebody like Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't also have Ruach HaKodesh, or that somebody who had Ruach HaKodesh couldn't also have prophecy. In fact, very much the case is usually they had both in all these situations. But the experiences were two different things. So the experience of divine inspiration is something that comes from the person in terms of who he is, and then his approach, his extension of himself into the metaphysical spiritual state. It's a metaphysical spiritual space. Though, for example, one of the levels of Ruach Kodesh that we say that belongs to every single person is at the time they give a name to their child. It says that when it comes time to choose a child's name, that Ruach Kodesh descends upon them and the name they give them is divinely inspired. Now, of course, you may be saying to yourself, did I have some divine experience in the naming of my child? Well, you did. The question is whether or not you perceived it. And whether or not you perceived it really, again, has to do with your level of preparation. As you can see, divine inspiration is something which occurs, but how much of an experience you have of it, or how much you can explore with it, is really based, again, on who you are and what you've attained. So, for example, on this simple level, again, as a person decides and to choose a name, so the ability is there, and how much he's able to understand of what's going on is really from that. So for some people, it's just sort of, wow, you know, Bubby had this name, and Zadie had that name, and let me think, what should I? But there is something to that. Very often, it may be planned out also. I mean, for example, both Ashkenazim and Sephardim have different customs, but customs regarding how the names actually apply to the children. So for example, by the Sephardim, it's sort of almost a given. The firstborn son is going to end up being the same name as the father's father. And it's not like you really have much of a choice of that, unless you, of course, want to experience extreme problems with your, you know, parents. And of course, the secondborn male ends up being your father-in-law's name. And again, unless you want to experience serious problems in your marriage and future family, you probably are going to give that child a name. But all of that still is within the framework, of course, of this Ruach HaKodesh. It may very well be that this is the divine plan and how things are. And plus, you do see sometimes that people will deviate slightly, perhaps a middle name, perhaps some change along those lines. So these things do occur, but again, those ideas are there. So beyond that, Ruach HaKodesh also may take various different forms. So, for example, certain forms of Ruach HaKodesh have to do with, again, a person entering into a certain meditative state, and then what occurs then is some sort of, I think they call it like auto-speech or something along those lines, where literally, in other words, a certain divine presence, a malach, for example, will be able to descend upon that person, and he'll actually be his kalim, and his physical body will then become the ability, will then become the physical kalim, the physical tool for which the expression of that divine ruach, the divine experience can occur. It can occur as within dreams. You know, there's various, we say that dreams have a certain element of truth and a certain element of falsehood to them. That also is in this idea of, again, Ruach HaKodesh, of divine experience that we're talking about. Other levels that are included within this divine experience have to be revelations of Elyon Navi. That Elyon Navi should be revealed to a person to teach him and to study with him. This is also called, again, an experience of Ruach HaKodesh. By the way, in all of these things, the common element is that you have to attain it. You have to go after it to achieve it, and not just through preparation in terms of series of rituals, and then if you happen to be Ro'oi, happen to be meritorious to receive such a inspiration, such as in prophecy, here in Ruach HaKodesh, and it still exists to this very day, a person is capable of going after it, meaning he is able to achieve a certain level of purity and a certain level of learning and striving, and therefore achieve different levels within this. That means to say that if a person stumbled across, there are some old books that exist that talk about, for example, various different meditative combinations and things like this. You see like Ari Kaplan's Kabbalah and Meditation or things like that. That means that a person could go ahead and read that and he would see what it said and he could perform the various exercises in meditation and he'd be able to achieve these divine experiences on the higher levels that we're talking about. And the answer to that is probably not. What I mean by that is that while, yes, he would be able to put himself in the proper state, the question is, has a person achieved the proper preparation for who he is to be able to enter into that state? There are ways of kickstarting the situation that are, for example, more forced might be the better way. But then you go to the story of Arba Shenichnas Lepardes, the four that entered into the orchard, where it says, of course, that only Rabbi Akiva actually entered and left without any blemish. Among the other three, one went insane, one went off the path altogether, and the other one never came back. So when you force the situation, that's not the way to go about things either. It happens to be the Rabbi Akiva, because he was prepared when he entered into these states of divine inspiration, was capable of achieving and bringing back what he experienced and assimilating that back into the physical world and into something that can be conducive and productive. In the case, for example, of Acher, the one that went off the path, he went and he saw, and he actually came to points where he experienced and saw things of a very high level. Actually says that there were things that certain Malach, the Malach Memtet, had allowed him to see certain things. For example, it says that he was writing down the merits of the Jewish people, and all of a sudden Acher comes back, Rishu ben Avua comes back, and he says, wait a minute, how could it be that a Malach is writing about what the Jewish people are doing, good and negative? Isn't that God is the only one that oversees what happens? Why is there a Malach, an angel, that's involved in this? And it says that the Malach Memtet, we're referring to the initials for the Malach, because we don't say the names of angels, says that this Malach then was taken and was given immediately lashes, 40 lashes of fire and various things that occurred. And actually, I'll answer that in a moment. But in other words, because of the fact that he allowed this Rav to have seen this experience, and as a result of that, this Acher went off. The reason why Acher, Rav Elisha ben Avua, went off the path, meaning he abandoned, in other words, continued observance of Torah. It's interesting. He didn't become a Christian. He didn't become, but he decided to no longer pursue continued observance of the Torah, was because after having experienced this and having had these thoughts which were heretical, meaning, oh, there's two things in heaven that are dealing with things, meaning God alone is not the one that makes the decision, that once he had that heretical thought, it was decreed that he would never have a place in the world to come, and therefore he says, well, might as well enjoy this world while I've still got it. So this is what happened in terms of Elisha ben Avua. By the way, why did this occur by him? Interestingly enough, was it says that he had, before, he didn't have the right preparation. It says that he was busy learning philosophy, and it says that he would sing non-Jewish songs. And he wasn't prepared to be able to assimilate the experiences he saw and to bring them down into a practical application that he'd be able to, again, bring into this world and make use of in a positive and forward way. And therefore, he went off the path.
What did he see?
He saw again the Malach, the Memtet, who was writing down the various merits of the Jewish people and their various negative sides. Isn't this in God's domain? Why is there an angel that seems to be, you know, basically dealing with the Jewish people? In other words, it should only be God. By the way, incidentally, a Malach is, like my grandfather always used to say, a Malach is like a robot. Angel is like a robot. So the question is, how could this angel have done something which would have, again, which would have compromised this rabbi's position, number one, and get punished for it? In other words, how could he have done this, so to speak, against God's will? It seems a bit of a problem. I'm sorry, correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So how could this angel have done something that seemingly would not have been directly his task? First of all, obviously it was his task to do that, but the question is, why is it that he was able to show or to allow this? Well, first of all, what we've already said about Ruach HaKodesh, that sort of you can look where you wish to look.
Yeah, but so, why would seeing that make that other person a heretic?
Because of his previous lack of preparation, in that he had spent time dealing with the philosophical questions.
Yeah, but why couldn't he think that an angel could do that?
He perhaps could have, but his preparations were off. Meaning, if you're approaching things with a Jewish Jewish mindset, so to speak,
right.
and you see the experience, you will accept with faith, and you'll later on try and deal with the issue and bring it down to
yeah, but
terms.
But why didn't he think that God so told the angels to do that?
Oh, because he, again, so he, well, no, no, no. Granted, why he didn't had to do with, again, his lack of preparation. He didn't think the right thought. His thoughts, that's why he got punished, because he should have thought the right thoughts, and he did not, because of the fact that he had, again, been spending so much time in various philosophical questions that he may have come to his own ideas, meaning not the ideas that the Torah espouses. And therefore, that's what brought him off the path. Despite the fact that he, again, being a great Rav in many ways, and there's long stories even that after this occurrence, that Rabbi Meir, one of his main students, continued to learn with him, even following this, but because of Rabbi Meir's greatness, he was able to pull out the good from the bad. And we say that in general, this is not something we can do in life, but Rabbi Meir was of, again, of the caliber. Angels, we never say the names of angels. Certain angels, for example, like Gabriel, is a name that we've given to children and people know, so therefore that's not an issue. But an angel's name, though, we never pronounce if it's not, again, also used as a person's name, things like that. The reason is because the nature of the soul is higher than that of an angel. So when you actually say the name of an angel, you actually, in a sense, conjure it, meaning that you have the ability to bind it and actually tell it what to do, almost. So by saying its name, you've drawn its attention. Simply because of the fact that you happen to have a neshama. So by virtue of that, you call his attention to you. What's the problem with calling the attention? Well, once you've called the attention of the angel questions, well, who are you to call me? In other words, there's a certain sense of envy that exists between the angels and man. So if you happen to be completely righteous, and you happen to be calling an angel, that's one thing. But if you're not, it's not something you want to be doing. You definitely don't want to be doing. In fact, it says it can have, what happens is it says that the angel then will bear your sins before God immediately. It says, this person who, this sin and this sin and this sin, he calls me to do this, he'll do what you said. And in fact, very much of the, what they call practical Kabbalah, has to do with the binding of angels. In other words, making use of their names as part of amulets and things like that to force them into doing what you want. But there's a price to pay. And I have personally seen people who have done this, and it does work, but I've also seen the fact that they ruin themselves and sometimes their future generations. I know someone, for example, who actually used this sort of thing in order to help other Jews. And as a result, I've seen their grandchildren still suffering from various issues. And I guess it's the best way to, spiritual issues and men. I mean, they're even religious people, but have real issues that are, again, many of them seem psychological, but certainly are beyond that. Well, God is God. Right.
Calling by name. You're not allowed to call for an angel, but could come to you, right?
That's another thing. If God sends an angel to you, that's another experience. Mm-hmm. But yes, to call upon an angel is considered to be a fairly dangerous thing. Incidentally, by the way, when it says that when a person talks, mentions the names of the tzaddikim, of the righteous people, that it also calls their merit before God and draws their attention as well. The difference between calling upon an angel and mentioning a righteous person, obviously you can't commend anybody in heaven to do anything, and certainly we don't pray to them or ask them for things or what have you, but by calling their merit, by saying their name to recall their merit before God, also draws their attention that they should also, again, beseech God on our behalf. Again, we're not asking them for anything. It's just something that happens. But what happens there is that some righteous person will never do anything to compromise you. So therefore, you have nothing to worry about. That's a real problem. That's a real problem. It's a problem. It's another. Perhaps maybe another discussion. We'll get more into that. There are actually some places in Navi where some of this comes into play. As a general rule, the answer to that is generally no. You could pray that God, in the merit of my grandfather, the merit of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you know, for you know this you know the prayer by the Sfarim, you know, on Slichot, Anenu Biskutei de Bar Yochai, as you know, that God should answer me in the merit of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. That's something different. It's another thing to say, you know, hey, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, will you do this and this and this for me to help me? That's a very problematic thing, sometimes bordering on avodah zarah, and on a foreign way of serving God. In fact, sadly, there are some things going on in our modern day, even certain groups where large portions of them have literally gone off astray from Judaism and approached this with a very very problematic approach. So but it's a problem. But for example, a person goes to pray by a grave. What is he doing there? What he's doing is, as we say, that for example, by a righteous person, that the Shekhinah, the presence of God, is greater found there. Which means that our ability to perceive godliness in that place is greater. You know, it's not God is everywhere and it's in every place, but our ability, and I mean the physical world, has a greater perception in that place of godliness. So when we go to pray at that grave, we're praying to God. But now it has nothing to do with the person sitting there, other than the fact that in his merit, we have a greater, and if you think about it, when you go there, you have a sense of awe when you're standing at the grave of the Arizal that you wouldn't find in another place. And therefore, when you're beseeching God, the merit of that righteous person is also there at your side because of the fact that in his merit, that's you're sitting there. You're doing, you're praying to God. I give an example. When I have a yahrzeit, and a person, you know, the custom of bringing, for example, various food stuff to the synagogue, so that on a yahrzeit, people should go and they should make blessings and a mezonot and a sheakol, and another in the merit of the person who passed on. What's the idea? Every time the person is going to make a mezonot, a sheakol, whatever, a blessing, he is doing so because of this person. He would not be eating this food. He would not be making these blessings. He would not be praising God and saying these things in the Torah if not for that person. So therefore, it's in his merit. He gains that merit. In a sense, this is sort of a flip side. You know, you're by this righteous person, and you're praying to God. In a sense, his righteousness, has brought you to experience a greater sense of godliness, and therefore it's in his merit also that your prayers come before God, and so forth. Correct. Right. In fact, if you were directly to be doing so, it actually, again, if you were to say, you know, in other words, so you know, Rebbe so and so, you know, Rav so and so, you know, that you should go to God and this and this and this, that would be straight out of Ozar. So that's a real problem.
Came back to prophecy, right? One of the other elements of prophecy is a need, a desire, something for God to transmit some information to this light world. If God doesn't have a need or a desire, need, want, whatever we want in there, to transmit information, to transmit prophecy to this place of existence, then why would he bother? Even if we do beseech him, we have.
Oh, so the answer is in prophecy, you're right. That's why there's no prophecy today. When as a result of the destruction of the temple and various other events, God withdrew prophecy from the world, it says except for the children and the fools. So if somebody is a prophet, if somebody is a prophet, you have to ask him, are you a fool or are you a child? In other words, it's only one of the two. You know, so prophecy in that sense, in other words, meaning again, of that nature, was withdrawn from the world by Kodesh Baruch Hu for again. So that doesn't mean to say there isn't any way for God to communicate with us. We'll get to that when we talk about the third form of communication in a couple minutes.
Yes,
well, certainly. Kodesh Baruch Hu has an interest, and also we'll talk a little about what the interest is when we get to the third one. So in that regard, Ruach HaKodesh, so the divine experience, divine inspiration, as we were talking about before, and all these various things, again, your preparation, we talked about Acher in terms of his experience, what allowed this Malach to do something which seemingly was not in his programming? In other words, what allowed him to go off? So what happens is you'll find the answer when you turn around and you look in Bereshit, in Targum Yonatan, where it talks there about Chanoch, right? That Chanoch says walked in the way of God and then was not. So something along those lines. I've got to look at the actual pasuk. So if the Targum Yonatan explains that actually that he was taken from the world before his time and brought into the heaven and made into the Malach Memtet. So actually, what you actually see was that the reason, by the way, was because he would go through these swings of being righteous and then not being righteous. So Kodesh Baruch Hu took him out on a righteous upswing, so that he shouldn't fall again. So he was taken then basically to become God's secretary, so to speak. But in this case, it was actually a neshama that was taken. So the neshama has a certain sense of independence that a malach doesn't. So you can see how this is possible that such a thing should exist. So. Again, that's one explanation, and again, there are many others as well. So along those same lines, what we find is that the divine inspiration is something which a person who is Osek, who is learning Torah, and is in the zone, as they would say, for in learning, will also find himself having that sense of experience, where again, where there's a sense of feeling that there's a sight in the Shemaya, help in heaven, and how many times a person is sitting and learning, and again, that he's having, again, literally just things seem to be opening up for him, and he's able to see and hear and understand something within his learning that has been closed to him and so forth, that again is divinely inspired. And we say that the texts of the Rishonim and various other things, they said that all these writings were written with Ruach HaKodesh, they were written with divine inspiration, meaning that everything that was written was written on this level again of them being in this in a sense of in a prepared state of holiness, and therefore in doing so there was divine guidance in everything they wrote. And when you start looking, for example, at the writings of these Chachamim, and you see sometimes the voluminous amounts of writing that they did, you say that there has to have been something quite miraculous involved. I have a shelf of writings of the Chidah that extends about the length of this table. I don't, for a person to do that much writing in the prime of his life, and it's a mind-boggling thing. The Ramakr of, remember, they didn't have computers and stenography and ability to sit with a little device that records your voice or any of these other. I mean, literally to be able to pour out, meaning to have that much knowledge and then be able to, again, not repeat yourself over 20, 35, some of his volumes, it's a pretty amazing feat. Yeah, there's, it says, for example, the Rav Moshe Kalavera wrote 72 volumes of writings, including entire commentary on the Zohar and various other. In fact, in his time, the first ever of such a commentary. In fact, it's interesting that those writings have only been printed since starting in the 60s, and they haven't even finished being printed for the first time ever. I mean, it's just the number again. You know, talking volumes and volumes. It's absolutely amazing, and you realize that there was something quite divine in what they were able to accomplish, but it was accomplished through their efforts. It didn't just happen. They put in an effort, and that effort was responded to from heaven. And that's the key. So the idea is your effort, and again, heaven's response. In the case of prophecy, it's more heaven's effort and you being ready to receive. Now, the third level, the third level that I'm going to discuss is the idea of troubles in one's life. Various experiences. I wouldn't say just troubles, experiences in one's life that lead people down different paths. What happens is that it is in God's interest that we succeed. So let's talk about from a couple of things. First of all, I had said that the highest level of a human being, you know, that he can reach is a perfect sense of anava, a perfect development of the trait of humility. What is the perfect trait of humility? It's not, as might be understood from the English word of humility, or being meek as a person, basically some nebuch guy that walks around, I'm a nobody and everybody doesn't like me. That's my low esteem is far a cry from the concept of being anav. Moshe Rabbeinu, let's put things into perspective. Moshe Rabbeinu was an extremely good-looking guy. That I can assure you, because in order to be a prophet, you have to be good looking. If you're an ugly guy, you're out of luck. Or gal, for that matter. It goes both ways. So, if you're ugly, you're out. Well, remember that a prophet is somebody that has to represent himself before the Jewish people as a leader. The fact is, I'm very sad to say, but basically ugly people don't get far in terms of leadership, not because of the fact that ugly people couldn't be good leaders, or wouldn't sometimes be the best of leaders, but because sometimes foolish people are not willing to look beyond the cover. So therefore, and this is the way things are, and of course, if God made you beautiful, then maybe potentially you could be a prophet. So think along those lines. By the way, I'm not so sure that beauty always means the same sense of beauty that we mean today. I can assure you that Moshe Rabbeinu did not walk around looking like somebody from Miami Vice or whatever the hottest show is to, you know, today, you know, with a 5 o'clock shadow and a cool looking, you know.
Charismatic, you better work.
So charismatic is definitely the key here, but looks are, I'm talking also about looks, meaning,
charisma is a broad term.
Right.
Sometimes personality, ability to talk
correct
to people.
Yes. Yeah. So definitely it's all the above. So he has to certainly be very charismatic and have that position. Second of all, so therefore, all, for example, he even goes a little further. He's got to be fairly tall. He has to be fairly, you know, have a presence. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Midrash presents Moshe Rabbeinu, if I recall, something like 20 feet tall. Again, it's an exaggeration. It's not meant to be taken literally. But it means to say that Moshe Rabbeinu was head and shoulders above most people. So along those lines.
It's unusual. It seems like statistical attributes wouldn't be there.
But it does very much. For example, a Kohen, here's an example. To be a Kohen, a practicing Kohen, if you were to be, God forbid, if somebody was to be somehow disfigured or maimed or anything else like that, he could not practice anymore as a Kohen. He's disabled. Yeah, he cannot practice as a Kohen because of the fact that what happens is he is on stage for the Jewish people. So therefore, if you come to the Beit HaMikdash and you see somebody who it's not going to work. People are going to see this and have the wrong impression. Sad but true. The fact is that not everybody is of a level to be able to really be able to appreciate what that person may have to offer.
Is there like really a list of people you can have this?
Yes, actually, there's Mishnayot that go through detail by detail, if his breath happens to stink too much, if this happens to be too much, if he works in certain industries where his hands are colored, even to this day, to be able to duchen, if a guy works in the dye industry, and it will be a shocking experience for people to see green hands, but he would not be able to practice as a Kohen, even today. So if this is something that, so physical attributes do come into play. From an American mindset, this may seem like a very sad type of thing, but in truth, think about again the role that he's playing, and things begin to change. He's on stage.
Politicians?
In a sense.
They didn't have the
many times over. I'm sorry?
FDR hit his disability.
Oh, there's no question.
They're no equal rights.
So. Well, obviously God made them, but if God made him maimed, it means to say that he wasn't meant to be in that position. Now, it doesn't mean to say he stopped being a Kohen, and it doesn't mean his children are not Kohanim. It's not like a guy who, God forbid, went off and married a non-Jewish girl, and therefore he loses, and his children lose, and everybody else loses. It's not that kind of a situation. It means to say that he cannot participate. And it doesn't even mean to say that he can't receive the various gifts that go to the Kohen either. It just means that he can't officiate in that position. By the way, from there we can understand, by the way, all the various purity laws concerning a Kohen. So, for example, a Kohen would not be allowed to marry a Jewish woman who had relations with a non-Jewish man. That's it. She's out of the category. That's it. In other words, one time in her life and boom, it's all over for him. Why? Simply because of the fact that other men will look at this Kohen and say, oh, this is the kind of woman he thinks. What kind of guy is he? Sad, whatever, maybe she was raped, God forbid, something, who knows what, right? She changed her life, she became a new person, she's a Bala Tshuva. Whatever it is, though, it's still, he's on stage. So therefore, things make it, even today, he's on stage in some sense. So therefore, certain rules begin to apply, and therefore he does it. And of course, maybe it was a good deterrent for young Jewish girls to know that, so maybe, for example, if they ever thought they might marry a Kohen, they better be careful. So whatever the case is, there are again, these things do exist for a reason. And so the Kohen has to be that. He has to be wealthy. Again, another thing is, what happens is that people, if somebody is not wealthy, sadly, sometimes they don't respect them. So that's part of the package. So again, he's got to be tall, he's got to be wealthy, he's got to be good looking, and he has to be wise in Torah, of course, and have good midot. These are, of course, the most important of all the traits, but they are there. Now, going back, in terms of Anava, so in all of these things, he has all of these traits. If you think about it, for the prophet who has everything, so to speak, he actually is in the position where he might be the very... he's in the most difficult position that most people could be in to actually be Anav, to actually be humble. I mean, he's got it all working for him. He's got looks, he's got money, he's got it. I mean, he's all this. He's got Torah, he's got everything rolling for him. That's exactly the case. His challenge is perhaps greater than anybody else. The greater potential for negativity also leads to the greater potential for positivity. What I mean is, I don't know if those are real words, but either way, what happens is like this. An Anav person does what Moshe Rabbeinu does. I am nobody. You think I'm rich? No. God gave me money to serve him. Whatever I have is God's. God gave me money. Yeah, okay, I'm rich. So yeah, I'm rich. By the way, a person who's truly anav, in the Hebrew word humble, can actually tell you, I'm anav. Get that one. If a truly humble person in Jewish law could tell you, I'm humble. It's an interesting idea. He'd actually be able to state it, because it's a matter of a fact. It's not a question of he either is or he isn't. If a person truly and completely and totally is, whatever I have, my wisdom is nothing. The truth is, I am nothing. The wisdom I have was only put in me to use to serve the Jewish people, to use to serve God. That's it. Whatever. In other words, a wise person and a non-wise person to me are the same. God gave them two different. He gave this guy a mallet and he gave this guy a scissor. This guy's job is to pound, this guy's job is to cut. What's the difference? This one's a bird, this one's a fox. What do you mean? The fox doesn't turn to the bird. Gee, you know, the bird doesn't turn to the fox. Hey, stupid, you can't fly. It just doesn't run that way. If I was a bird, I'd be flying. If you were a fox, you'd be running. It just doesn't work. It's the same thing. A truly honest person recognizes that, you know what, everything I have is nothing. What I am is nothing more than a person that God gave me certain things to serve him with and to make use of. And then it's a question of how well I make use of them. And that's another matter. If a person and really thinks about all the kalim, all of the tools that God has given him, how well does he make use of them? Well, that actually could bring a person into that broken state that sometimes we associate with humility. I'm not using everything I have for the sake of God. I'm not using everything I have to serve him the way I should. That's true. He really isn't. In other words, if any one of us thought about what we have and how much are we really putting 100% in, we realize it's just not there. That brings us that sense of, again, of brokenness. But it comes from that, not from the sense of I'm nobody. I'm everybody. I'm great. Look at all the great stuff God gave me. But I'm not doing what I should be. This other guy over here, he's not. He's got 100 IQ and he's barely able to hold a job. He's greater than me because he's doing all he should be doing. He's using everything he is to serve God. He's going to shul on time. He's getting up in the morning. He's doing. This guy is somebody. Me, I'm nobody. Because I have all this and I'm not using it the way I should be using it. Oh, that's that idea of the lowness. But on the other hand, the idea of confidence is the most important trait that you're going to find, by the way, in any great leader. Of course, there's two types of confidences. The confidence which comes from gava, follow me, I am great. The other type of confidence, and the confidence that really belongs to the prophet, is the confidence that comes from anava, from humility. What does it mean? I am on a mission to do God's will. God put me in a position where I had money, I had looks, and God talks to me. You know what that means? It means I'm on a mission for God. I can't fail because I'm in His service. That's it. Guaranteed 100%. If I jump off the mountain, God will catch me because I'm so... Now obviously, that's a little exaggeration, but the point is, I'm on a mission to accomplish, and I will accomplish. Why? Because God put me there. If God gave me the ability to study, and I'm studying, I will accomplish because I can study. Because God made me able to study. Why? If I'm going to use this to serve Him, it will work, it will happen. In fact, success is guaranteed provided you just choose to enlist. Very simple. So the truly honest person has a real sense of confidence. When I tell you, follow me, it's because God told me what to do. You come on, let's go. And he throws himself in headfirst into the middle of the battle with no questions of anything to worry about because God is his co-pilot. No problem. Now, again, exaggerating all this, but you see the key here is that I'm nothing. He's nothing. What are you talking about? The honest person is nobody. Everything can be accomplished. Now, this is the greatest level. Of course, as greater and greater as you get higher and higher in terms of all that is anava. And this is what everybody's pursuing. So God's interest is that we should be able to achieve this. This in terms of who we are, in the terms of the person we are, and everything else. And of course, most importantly, that we should achieve the service of God to our fullest capacity, our capacity. Nobody's going to ask you, why weren't you like Rabbi Akiva? You're not Rabbi Akiva. They're going to ask you, why weren't you like you? So along those lines, prophecy, as we see, is very tied to our being in the land of Israel. Of course, there's some elements of us, again, the coming out of Egypt, whatever. But it's very tied to Eretz Israel. So first of all, you can understand why prophecy may be out, because even though we may have the state of Israel, the state of Israel is a secular government sitting on the face of a holy country. I'm not trying to take sides here, one with the other, being Zionist, not being Zionist, don't get me wrong. what I'm trying to say is that we haven't yet achieved that, again, a return of David HaMelech's line, being the king of Israel, and all these other things that go into truly being in control of the land, and totally, and of course, and the temple and so forth. So, all these things are not the way they are, because Baruch Hu withdrew prophecy. But prophecy was a means by which God communicated to the Jewish people how they should refine themselves to the highest possible level. Now, this third level of communication is exactly along those same lines. But instead of being on a nationalistic level, or being even within, again, a level of a leader and followers, it's an individualistic approach. Although there certainly is an idea that the troubles that happen to us collectively is also along these same lines. That when troubles happen in Israel, it's because we are not acting the way we should. And therefore we should be changing the way we are and modifying our life to fit the life that God wants from us. And then things will go well in Israel. Things will go everywhere. You know, when there is trouble going on, it's us, meaning ourselves, that we need to look into and how we need to modify how we behave and what we do. On an individualist level, though, the troubles in life and the things that occur in our life experiences, good and positive, are something which God gives us in order to lead us towards something greater, a refinement of who we are. God presents us with situations in life that we make use of in order to refine our being, to refine who we are. It is a direct communication from a Kadosh Baruch Hu when, God forbid, something good or bad happens. This is something we have to truly take to heart. Now, I'm not talking that you take signs from things because of the fact that a bird flew before me and I saw a dead bird the other day and this happened, that happened, and this is going to happen in my life. That's not at all what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is when the positive and negative things are experienced, do I now reflect into myself and say, am I on a path that is leading towards total use of all of my faculties in the service of God or not? When a good thing happens to me, is this a good thing that's going to take me away from all the positive things? Or is this God leading me in a direction where I should be applying myself even more to His service, where I should be doing more to be the best that I can be? Choosing what's right and wrong, in a sense, is not the ultimate aspect of free will. Think about it. A dog, when it sees a fire, he runs away. When he sees water, he runs to drink. This is the lowest basis thing. An animal never chooses to do what's going to be harmful to themselves. So therefore, a human being in nature, if it was left alone without, for example, perhaps the Yetzirah, would never do anything against God. So the Yetzirah does incorporate initially to us the ability to go off the path and do the wrong thing or do the right thing. But in reality, what happens is that if you think about it, anything you would do that would be off the path of what God wants from you would in fact be detrimental to your soul, and therefore something that you should automatically choose to take the right path. In fact, there's really no free will about it. You have to do the right thing. If you decide to do the wrong thing, then you have actually gone against, really, your own, against Seichel. You've gone against being sane. You've gone insane, for that matter. To do anything that would be an avera, would be a sin, is actually a form of insanity. It says that Ein Adam, excuse me, a person doesn't sin until enters him a ruach, a spirit of folly. The Gemara in Brachot brings this down. That means to say you wouldn't do something wrong unless a spirit of folly overcame you and made you go in that direction. That means to say you were insane. That doesn't give you an excuse, but it means you were insane. So what happens is we have to make an effort to choose to be sane. But now, in terms of being sane and doing the right thing, though, that's where free will really is held. And what do I mean? In terms of doing everything, there's two ways to do something in life. For example, I tell my children that they should clean their room. Well, you know what? There's two ways they can clean their room. One way is they go in, oh, I can't believe you're taking away from my friends and all the things I want to do. Yeah, I'm going to clean my room because you told me to do it. And now, if he doesn't clean his room, he's going to get punished and all this other stuff. But that's out of fear. But in the sense of he's doing it, but he's doing it because I told him to do it. That's wonderful. He's doing a mitzvah. He's following his father. He's following his mother. He's cleaning his room. The other way is he says, okay, it's time to clean my room. yeah, you know, I'm going to clean my room, it's going to be really great, but not just because I'm going to be doing what my parents want. I'm going to be doing it because Shabbos is coming. I'm going to be, you know what I mean? Like, for example, my kids have this thing they call Chevra Bowl. They came up with this name for themselves. I don't even know if it's a translation. It's a word they made up, which basically just means, it sort of means like the corporate cleaners, I guess. And what they do is when it comes Erev Shabbat, and my wife says to them, okay, it's time to clean up, they start singing, and they run around the house doing all the cleaning, da-na-na-na-da-da-da-da, and they have this whole song that they start singing and everything, and they make like this construction crew and whatever, and they do this whole thing. No. But anyways, they do this whole thing. Now, of course, for the parents, what kind of experience is that? They've done what you've asked, but they did it with a smile.
And singing.
Now, and of course, and they really do. They're getting ready for Shabbos, and they have this planned out every week. They're going to be the Chevra Bowl, and it's like they have this whole game they play. Now, we didn't even come. They came up with it. So what I'm trying to say, now that is something. That is something. If we serve God in that way, then you are serving with free will. Meaning you have chosen to serve God in a fashion which is beyond the fashion of doing what God wants. Of course you have to do what God wants. You don't have a choice to do a sin. When you choose to sin, you're not making a free choice. You have inspired yourself, you have worked yourself up to doing the wrong thing. But in terms of a choice though, you can choose to serve God with, I'm doing what God wants, I'm going to shul, or I'm going to talk to my Creator. He's beyond me, beyond everything, and He allows me to talk to Him. Let alone me, nobody. He lets me talk to Him. Oh my God, what an experience, what an opportunity. Two different ways in terms of serving. That's real, free choice is truly in that aspect. Now again, we do have physical and various other things that drive us and pull us in the wrong direction. And we can, and there is a sense of choice between doing a sin and not doing a sin. But those choices are choices that are based on our, again, material preparation, based on our material experiences in life, based on all kinds of other things. How we were born, where we are, what we know, are based on all kinds of other things. Therefore, they're based on something. They're not free. They're not true choices in the sense of completely free from any exterior ulterior motive. You have no ulterior motive to serve God with a sense of awe and inspiration, a sense of true feeling inside. You don't have nothing in you that says to you, you should or you should not do that. But you could do it if you chose to. That is real free will. So the experience between doing right and wrong is not really free will. It is a choice. And you do get credit. You get positive, you know, credit in heaven for choosing not to sin. But in truth, when you get to a certain level, eventually, you're not going to sin because, listen, you know, the likelihood, cheeseburgers, the smell alone makes me sick. I'm not going to go eat a cheeseburger. It's just reality. It's not a choice for me not to eat it. It's disgusting to me. So much of one's life eventually begins to follow that approach where the negative, especially if you've been born into it and you've accustomed to it, or if you continue in your life and you grow, you become accustomed to what's right or wrong, hopefully all, in other words, to everything that's right, and you don't get customs, and you don't gain a sense of habit for the wrong thing. But if all your habits are positive and none of your habits are negative, you're going to do the right thing all the time. But choice really is, again, in that matter. Do you have a question?
Well, more like I've been told, taught, whatever, that someone who's Baal Teshuva, when they do something at some higher level than someone who's broken birth, because the person who's Baal Teshuva knows what that cheeseburger tastes like, and they're more tempted than someone who's broken birth doesn't know what a cheeseburger is. Someone who's
by the way,
when I come to shul, it's not because that's out of habit or tradition or that. It's because I make a very conscious effort to change myself.
By the way, just for your record, 99.999% of Baalei Teshuva don't fall into that at all. I'll explain to you now why. Almost everybody who's a Baal Teshuva today is somebody who was grown without all the positive experiences and is now choosing to do something right. A Baal Teshuva that's being talked about there is a person. I'm going to explain. It's important. Who was righteous, was grown with all the right things, and then went in the wrong direction and comes back. Now, here's the thing. That level is what's talking about is greater than the righteous. The person who comes for nothing now and comes all the way back is even greater than that.
Right. Okay.
Meaning it's even a greater level than that, and regarding that it says that his place is right there by the actual kisei kavod, by God's holy chair. So it's actually even of a greater level. So this is another matter. Because there he has no reason to choose anything positive, and he decides to choose something positive. So there his choice of doing something good is in fact already a form of free choice, because there's nothing compelling him that he has to do the right thing or the wrong thing. He didn't have the experiences that set him up with the idea of what's right and wrong. So therefore, when that person chooses to do right, it's already on a level that is, again, at a level of free will. And in a sense, you might say that every time a Baal Tshuva that we're talking about now, this type of a modern day Baal Tshuva, every time he chooses to eat kosher, he could just assume eat non-kosher. There's nothing compelling him not to. When he decides to eat kosher, it's on the same level of a big tzaddik who now has to work him up himself to say, oh, I'm eating a piece of kosher meat because God wants it from me. You know, and it's a tough one because it tastes good. So, in other words, the difference in experience is quite different because he's choosing to do a holy experience. But for a great tzaddik, it's very difficult for him to be able to experience that on the same level as that Baal Tshuva.
So, okay, so I did understand.
Yeah, you understand, but it's actually even more than that. That's my point.
So there's three levels. There's two levels.
Yeah. So in terms of all of this, is what we see is that this third level of the individual experiences within life actually is, in a sense, you might say, higher than prophecy almost. You know, it is a prophetic experience. And in fact, every one of us is able to experience it in a level. It does lack, though, as you see, in a sense, each one of these was a lower level of direct divine revelation. But in a sense, each level, though, was actually higher in terms of the individual experience that we have from it. Now, in terms of what we're hopefully going to accomplish as we go through Navi, is that we're going to look here at the key messages that were being given by the prophets in terms of who and what we should be doing to be greater. In other words, that prophetic message that's being given over to us, in terms of how to refine ourselves and make ourselves better. In other words, how to go ahead and go forward in life without having to experience anything negative to get there. In other words, you have a choice in life. You can take the school of hard knocks and therefore experience anything that could even be negative in order for you to know what to do positive. Or why don't we follow somebody who has already gone the path, in a sense, or has actually gotten a freebie from God of what to do positive, and just follow after him and do what he does. So in that sense, we're looking to gain now all the freebies that God has to offer by going through the prophets and the writings and basically picking freebie after freebie of how we can, again, make the right choices for a finer and more refined service of God and finer and more refined sense of who we are. Meaning to develop this again, the sense of divine confidence is, yeah, I'm on the mission to serve God. With that, God, we will start with Yeshua with the first experience next week, I believe.